Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So is Mitt Romney shaking up his Etch-a-Sketch and redrawing his campaign for the center for the general election, or aligning himself with the Republican right by endorsing the Ryan budget? We talked about Ryan budget issues yesterday with Raihan Salam from The Daily and National Review Online. Today we'll hear from Chris Hayes, Washington editor for The Nation magazine and host of Up with Chris Hayes, weekends from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on MSNBC. He also has a new book coming out this spring called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for coming on today. Welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be on, Brian.
Among the topics you dealt with on your show over the weekend was the idea that the Republicans are crying uncle in the culture wars. Do you see that happening?
I do, in the sense that there was a kind of confluence of events that happened, and I don't think there was much of a grand strategy, actually, on either side. I think it was largely an accident that you had the uproar over the Susan G. Komen Foundation pulling its, or saying it was going to pull its future funding of Planned Parenthood. You then had the HHS issue its regulatory ruling on control of contraceptives for women as part of the preventative care that's included in the Affordable Care Act, the ensuing uproar, the Sandra Fluck incident in which a Georgetown law student was, you know, slandered by Rush Limbaugh on the radio, and all this sort of coalesced into what Democrats call the war on women. And that also kind of nicely paralleled a moment in the primary when Rick Santorum was rising to prominence, Rick Santorum, who famously said about birth control, it's not okay. All of that kind of came together to put Republicans, I think, on the wrong side politically of a culture war, quote-unquote, wedge issue, which was women's reproductive self-determination, women's health, birth control, et cetera. And I think Democrats are used to being in a defensive crouch when these culture wars arise. And
yeah.
I very quickly realized that they were actually on the winning side of this. And now you have Republicans complaining about the issue surfacing, which to me indicates they think they've lost it, that they are losing it. When you have Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, saying, well, the Democrats are calling it a war on women and the press is just reporting it. And now there's this sort of conspiracy theory that this was all engineered by Democrats. That to me is a tacit acknowledgement of the fact that they really screwed this up politically.
That's really interesting to me, because you're right. People tend to think of culture war issues as wedge issues that benefit Republicans. But you're saying,
in fact, that's the origin of it. I mean, that's, you know, there's this really famous memo that Pat Buchanan, of all people, authored for Richard Nixon about re-election, in which he sort of talked about, finding issues that kind of cleave apart the one Democratic constituency for another, busing being a famous one. And there's a lot of kind of post-traumatic stress among Democratic political operatives,
right,
and I think among liberals, having seen themselves get wedge issued to death year after year after year. And it's hard for them to come to realize, actually, on some of these things, and I think gay marriage is getting there, the wedge now benefits you. It actually cuts the different constituencies of the Republican base off from each other.
Well, that's really interesting if the worm has turned that much, because the problem for Democrats is that culture war issues have been used historically to pry liberal economy voters away from the Democrats by convincing them that Democrats don't share their values about life and family. And I think gay marriage was used as precisely that kind of a wedge when the Republicans got it on the ballot in the 2004 presidential election year in a number of states, very importantly, including Ohio, which got a larger Republican turnout than they might have had otherwise. But now you're saying that if that same issue were to appear in, I don't know, maybe New Jersey, where Chris Christie would like it to be on the ballot, that it might actually benefit Democratic turnout?
I think in certain parts of the country it would. I mean, I think New Jersey is probably one of them. I don't think the worm has completely turned, right? But polling, you know, it's hard to identify an issue that has the sort of polling, the sort of longitudinal trajectory of polling on gay marriage. There's nothing really like it. I mean, it is steadily increasing in terms of support,
right,
nationwide, and it's hard to see what's going to reverse that.
Yeah.
I mean,
because it's by age, basically.
Exactly. It's entirely demographic. I mean, so if you take people over 65 and you take them out of the pool, then there's pretty solid majority support.
So do you see Romney moving toward the center on culture wars issues? He had that famous moment, and I wish I had thought to pull the clip for today, but where he had on this whole contraception thing and the Blunt Amendment in the Senate, which would have given any employer, not just religious employers, the right to deny contraception coverage to their employees based on their individual religious beliefs. He said, well, no, this is supposed to be between a man and a woman, private stuff. I don't support that amendment. And then there was such an outcry that his campaign issued a correction and said, no, no, he meant to say that he does really support the Blunt Amendment.
He misunderstood the question, I think, was the technical explanation.
Yeah, right. But in general, now that he seems to have the nomination locked up, is he already visibly, to your eye, tacking back toward the center on things like this?
The only thing that I would say visibly that he seems to be tacking towards the center on is with respect to immigration, with respect to sort of trying to court Latino voters. He was, you know, one of the things that he did very deftly in the primary was he chose immigration as an issue that he could get to the right of some of his competitors, Rick Perry famously, right? Mm. So Rick Perry, you know, was a threat to him when he announced. He, it sort of seems silly to think of that as being the case, but he looked formidable when he first entered the race, and Mitt Romney gleefully wielded immigration, hard right immigration, sort of restrictionist rhetoric, as a cudgel to beat up on Rick Perry, who had signed a piece of legislation that allowed children who had come to the country, brought to the country by their parents, no volition of their own, to attend state universities as in-state residents. Romney, I think, realizes that's going to be a problem, and his advisors certainly do, and the sort of smartest strategists in the Republican Party understand that the kind of toxic brand the Republicans currently have with Latinos that is grounded in their rhetoric on immigration, not even necessarily immigration policy, just a sense that this fundamentally is a coalition hostile to your kinds of people.
Right.
He's been trying to turn that around a little bit. That's the only place where I've seen any kind of real rhetorical pivot. I think part of the problem Romney has is that even after he has locked up the nomination, which at this point he hasn't, you know, mathematically locked it up, but it seems more and more inevitable, he still has to worry about enthusiasm, I think, among the base. And he still also has to worry about this perception of etch-a-sketching, right, of rewriting his policies, of flip-flopping, et cetera. If he pivots too quickly,
yes,
right, all he does is sort of play into that narrative. So he's in a bit of a bind, because at one level, every candidate has to pivot from the primary to the general election because of the different constituencies to which you are appealing. At the same time, he has a special talent for doing that clumsily and inartfully.
Yes.
And if he does it too quickly now, all
yes,
it does is further cement people's conception of him as a flip-flopper.
Right. Chris Hayes, host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC weekend mornings, and the Washington editor for The Nation magazine. On that same point, Thomas Edsel, in his New York Times op-ed the other day, cited various recent Romney speech lines as indicating a centrist tack. His Wisconsin night primary win speech included a reference to over 30% of single mothers struggling in poverty, the most vulnerable among us. In addition, he stopped saying Obama was for an entitlement society, swapping it out for a government-centered society. Edsel finds that a softer line. Do you buy those?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's the beginnings of some rhetorical shifts there. And again, it's not surprising to find them, you know, with respect to single women, who are probably the most bedrock Democratic constituency in national elections and even in local elections, that, you know, they cannot. I mean, if you just look at the exit polling from John McCain, right? He lost. He won about 30% of Latinos. The last polling of Mitt Romney had him at about 14 or 15%. So he has to outperform John McCain among Latinos, and right now he's underperforming. And also, John McCain lost by about 13 points among women to Barack Obama. Mitt Romney probably has to overperform there as well, or you have to make it up somewhere else, but it's unclear where you do. So those two constituencies and eating into those margins, I think, are probably going to be the prime strategic objectives of the campaign going forward, because those are the two constituencies that I think the primary and the primary rhetoric and what he has had to say in the primary has hurt him the most.
That makes a lot of sense. So what do you think this all predicts about Romney as a potential president? He was governor of Massachusetts, after all, where he's still fairly popular. He did institute universal health care with the model Obama then used. He's not Rick Santorum or Gingrich or Ron Paul on the economy with, you know, all that those names imply. Can Democrats get really scared of Romney the way they might have with the others? And might, if he's elected, might he actually turn out to be sort of a Bloomberg pragmatist?
It's very funny you ask that question, because that is the core fear of people around the president's reelection campaign, is that people, because of his inauthenticity, people, that actually ends up being a benefit to Romney, because people basically say, well, he was just saying that stuff in the primary, and, you know, he'll say anything, but that's not really where his heart is. And I think you have to look at the sort of structural nature of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party has become a very disciplined enterprise. Particularly in Congress, it votes almost entirely as a bloc on almost everything. Even in cases in which you have members at the margins whose districts probably support a given piece of policy, it's very hard to peel away Republican votes. There's a whole set of interlocking institutions on the American right and among the sort of Republican Party that enforce that discipline. They enforce that discipline in terms of who policies benefit vis-a-vis special interests, certain special interests that are particularly strong in the coalition, and also certain ideological do not cross lines. And so Mitt Romney, in some ways, isn't the issue. The issue is the nature of the modern Republican Party and what it will mean to have a Republican president. Whoever is in whoever's sitting at that desk is going to inherit the entirety of the structures of modern conservative governance.
Yeah, the difference, I guess, might be between him and John Boehner, that Boehner could have actually gotten defeated, you know, if he had actually struck that grand bargain with President Obama on deficit reduction. The Tea Party wing of his caucus could have actually defeated the proposal. Romney would be the president, so we would have more political autonomy from the party.
I just don't think that's true, because I think that ultimately, I mean, if you go back to the famous George H.W. Bush read my lips moment, right, which I think was kind of a turning point where he said, read my lips, no new taxes. He then, he then did raise taxes as part of a budget deal that he cut with Democrats, precisely in the kind of vein that we're talking about, right?
Right.
Deficit reduction, some changes to revenue, some changes in spending.
Right.
He did exactly that sort of thing and, you know, famously lost. And Grover Norquist, who's the head of Americans for Tax Reform, you know, has forever trumpeted that as an example, whether true or not.
Right.
Of why you can't cross him on that.
Buchanan primaried him.
Yeah, and Buchanan primaried. I just, it's very hard for me to envision if he's going to run for a second term, which I'm sure, you know, if he were to win, he would, that not sort of hanging over him like a sort of Damocles. The other thing I'll say is, you know, it's important to remember George W. Bush, if you listen to him on the campaign trail about foreign policy, remember he talked about us having a humble foreign policy. He sounded all these sort of isolationist notes. The fact of the matter is, the people who inhabit it, who inhabit the high offices of the sort of foreign policy establishment in exile among conservatives are neocons and are hawks. So it didn't actually matter that much, whatever George Bush said on the campaign trail about foreign policy. What mattered was, when he got in office, he was surrounded by these people that had extremely, extremely militaristic views on foreign policy. I think it's a similar situation with Mitt Romney. Whatever he's saying, the people who will be around him are going to be products of the coalition that has put him into power.
Chris Hayes from The Nation and MSNBC. Yesterday we talked with Raihan Salam from National Review Online and Rupert Murdoch's The Daily. He wrote a piece last week arguing that if the Ryan Medicare budget is radical, so is Obama's, because they each propose to cut Medicare to the same number. Here's the clip.
The big driver of increased federal expenditures over the next several decades is going to be the expansion of the Medicare program. Basically, a lot of people tend to get much more in benefits out of the Medicare program than they paid into the system, in part because medical care cost growth is increasing really dramatically. And so the question is, how do you actually curb that growth over time? In President Obama's last budget proposal and in Paul Ryan's budget proposal, they both propose limiting the growth of Medicare expenditures to GDP plus 0.5%. That is the exact same growth rate.
In other words, it's a half a point higher than the growth in the overall U.S. economy.
Exactly. This is despite the fact that actually medical care cost growth has been actually a fair bit more than GDP plus 0.5% in recent years.
So, Chris Hayes from The Nation, I wonder if you've taking a look at that. Bottom line there from Raihan Salam, both the Obama budget and the Ryan budget would limit the growth in Medicare spending to a half a point above GDP. Therefore, it's hard to make either one of them a scary monster.
Well, No. I mean, first of all, the Medicare proposal from Ryan is just one part of a budget that, let's remember, envisions that by 2050, along the path it lays out, that non-defense discretionary spending almost is zeroed out in the budget, okay? So that is a radical vision. That is where he wants to steer the budget towards.
How about just on Medicare, where a lot of this apparently is going to be fought?
So on Medicare, there's a few things here. First of all, there's a background context, which is the Affordable Care Act is a 2,700-page bill, famously, and the bulk of that has to do with changes to the healthcare delivery system. And I'm saying the bulk of it in terms of the amount of pages in that bill, changes to the healthcare delivery system to do precisely what Raihan mentioned, which is to bend the cost curve, slow the rate of growth in healthcare expenditures. Healthcare expenditures have been growing for a long time above inflation. They're actually growing faster in private insurance than they are in Medicare. Medicare actually is a softer curve, but it's still growing to such an extent that not only will the government have a problem paying for Medicare, but the entire society, right, will end up in a place where it's, 50 cents of every dollar in the entire economy is going to healthcare. So healthcare costs have to be slowed. The question is, how do you do that? The way that the Ryan plan envisions that is to essentially put it onto the consumer and say, well, this is what the cost that we're allowing to grow is. You get X amount of dollars, and if it's above that, well, then too bad. And the vision is that consumers can exercise a kind of restraining price control on the cost of medical delivery. And what we've seen through a whole variety of different studies and a whole variety of different ways is that healthcare markets don't work that way. There's a whole bunch of reasons that's the case. One of them is that people are making decisions about their healthcare through a position of asymmetric information. They don't have the information the doctor does or the insurer does or the specialist does. People are often making those decisions under intense duress. They're making them under the advice of other people. So the healthcare market fundamentally functions in a different way.
And you don't know when you buy a health insurance policy which kind of coverage you're actually going to need.
Exactly.
Because you don't know what kind of illness you're going to get, especially for older people who we're talking about on Medicare.
That's exactly right. So there's all sorts of ways. I mean, the core policy idea driving the Ryan budget is that you can basically shift costs from government onto the actual insured person, the senior citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And that they then, because they're not government, the profligate government that likes to give away goodies, they're the sort of virtuous, sensible consumer, that they'll be able to sort of discipline the market into lowering the rate of growth of cost. And I just don't think there's any empirical evidence for that.
The other side of that, the Republican side, is that it's the president who has the scary monster means of cost control, because he's got this government panel, the so-called IPAB, which would review reimbursement based on best practices and what's been proven to work. And that's where they get into, saying government death panels and all that kind of thing, because what would you rather do, be the consumer in the market who makes these choices with the private insurance company, or be at the mercy of an unelected government panel, kind of like the Supreme Court, but that's another show, an unelected government panel that is making those decisions as to what you're going to be covered by. And so I guess part of this gets fought out on which is scarier for the average American.
That's right. And let me just put a plug in for that vision. So in terms of the difference of where Ryan and Obama see, changing the cost structure of both healthcare and Medicare, which is the long-term challenge, the idea that was started in the Affordable Care Act is carried through in the budget is to do those on the delivery and provider side, right? There is a lot. This is hard for Americans, I think, to get their head around. Our healthcare system has a tremendous amount of waste and inefficiency in it. In fact, a study by Don Berwick, who was the head of CMS under Obama, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicare, Medicare and Medicaid, they estimate that anywhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion a year of medical spending is wasted. Think of something very simple, okay? Think of the fact that 10 years ago, hospitals did not have those Purell dispensers in every room, right?
Yeah.
That's a fairly recent innovation. The best practice of getting doctors and nurses and everyone who comes in and out of a hospital room to sterilize their hands with Purell actually turns out to be really effective at containing vectors of infection that happen in hospitals. And those vectors of infection are really expensive. The readmit rates, people go to the hospital to get well and they end up with staph infections, which is a real problem. There are whole lots of ways to squeeze the waste out of the system and to produce a healthcare delivery system that delivers higher quality and lower cost. And that's the vision that they tried to sort of put the framework for, lay the groundwork for in the Affordable Care Act, and is the bulk of what the future budget heads towards.
We have 1 minute left. I just do want to mention that you have a book coming out, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, and we would love to have you back for a proper book interview at that time. But why Twilight of the Elites, and how does it relate to the election in under a minute?
I think accelerating inequality in the country has produced a set of elites who cannot help but be blinkered and also corrupt and produce failure. And we've seen a cascade of institutional failure in the last decade, and it has produced a widening gap of distrust between the populace and the country's central institutions. And that widening gap of distrust is the kind of tectonic plates that all of the political all the kind of political arguments we have are emanations of. So this, the fact that we can't trust the media, we can't trust government, we can't trust Wall Street and big business, that lack of trust means that we're sort of afloat. we're like the astronaut with his connection to the ship cut off, and that makes navigating public life incredibly difficult.
So is it going to be Romney represents the conservative business elite, and Obama represents the liberal law professor elite in election terms, or not really?
Well, I think no. I mean, that will be the subtext, right? Because it is essentially two different kinds of elite.
Right.
Excuse me, sorry. It is essentially two different kinds of elite squaring off against each other. And to be honest, that is often what an American presidential election is.
We don't get a lot of sneezes on the air. That was very authentic. A moment of authenticity from Chris Hayes, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and host of Up with Chris Hayes, which airs from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Saturday and Sunday mornings on MSNBC, and author of the forthcoming book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Thank you so much.
That was great, Brian. I love the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, our own Alex Goldmark from our Transportation Nation project on why drivers who hit bicyclists aren't prosecuted more. Stay with us.